Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of September 14th, 2017. Today we're joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Doing well. How are you doing?
Good. Good to have you here. So, D.R., we've had a topsy-turvy, tumultuous few weeks, and people in the United States are being battered in many ways. People listening to this podcast probably know about Hurricane Harvey that beat up on Houston and Hurricane Irma that beat up on Florida, and how out in the Pacific Northwest there are forest fires raging at an unbelievable rate, probably assisted by drying climate related effects. And around the world, there are, of course, stories we haven't even covered of flooding in the monsoons and mudslides, and it's a sort of a biblical circumstance. But it brings up, not that we don't want to talk about that, but let's go to a higher level, right? We humans live and swim in a cultural, sociological, economic system that we barely even take account of. But the system we live in is radically different from what feudal society, right? We have built a society of economics where a profit and loss, that where we are, and people think this is the natural way, the only way to live. And I guess given the onslaught of what we see today in climate as a precursor or the future happening before our eyes, what big, I suppose, cultural, philosophical questions present themselves, DR? I mean, I know you've been doing some reading. I mean, what's a hot topic to discuss at that 30,000-foot level?
Well, the hot topic is touched upon by two pieces, one by Naomi Klein in The Intercept and one by George Monbiot in The Guardian, discussing the phenomenon of whether or not ideologies will shift as a result of these extreme weather events, and Naomi Klein and George Monbiot concluding no, Klein's arguing in her piece that the prospect that this will result in an ideological shift among those who've denied the science is far-fetched, because if they acknowledge what the science shows, that means they will have to forfeit virtually the entirety of their ideology. At one point, Naomi Klein argues that in perhaps the most significant portion of the piece is that, quote, lowering our emissions quickly enough to avoid catastrophic warming requires confronting the centrality of ever-expanding consumption in how we measure economic progress, unquote. And later she argues, quote, global warming really does have radical progressive implications. If it's real and it manifestly is, then the oligarch class cannot continue to run riot without rules, unquote. And George Monbiot, in his piece, explicitly
Monbiot
says,
quote, over in The Guardian.
In The Guardian, he says, quote, the environmental crisis is an inevitable result not just of neoliberalism, the most extreme variety of capitalism, but capitalism itself. And the myth of the self-regulating market accelerates the destruction of the self-regulating earth, unquote. So two very provocative pieces, I would say, especially in the United States context.
Right. And the connection back to the weather we've been seeing is that, if we're going to come to terms with the changing climate, there are some profound questions that have to be asked, right, D.R.?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, what was your you go first. I'll let you start, and then I'll play devil's advocate. What are they right? Do you think that and give me a clear statement of what the articles, both articles, are saying. And I guess I'll give you my own expression, is that capitalism as a philosophy of consumption cannot continue forever, right? Isn't that the statement?
Yes, in large measure, that's what the pieces are arguing, which is a direct contradiction to a, and this is why I think it's within the United States context it's so controversial, it's a direct contradiction to a piece that Paul Krugman wrote in April 2014, in which he declared, quote, there's no necessary one-to-one relationship between growth and pollution. On the left, you sometimes find environmentalists asserting that to save the planet, we must give up on the idea of an ever-growing economy. On the right, you often find assertions that any attempt to limit pollution will have devastating impacts on growth, but there's no reason we can't become richer while reducing our impact on the environment, unquote. Now, obviously, both ideas cannot be true. So one idea has to trump, no pun intended, the other. And my takeaways from the Klein and Monbiot pieces is, number one, if in fact consumption, capitalist consumption, is the problem, then that explains more so than any other factor why commercial media outlets are reluctant to cover this issue, because when commercial media outlets cut to the commercials, they're discussed, their advertisers are the very consumers that Klein and Monbiot argues are causing the problem. And number two, this does suggest that if in fact within the United States, within the United States context, a massive political mobilization against consumption and against capitalism cannot be put together, then in fact the United States will not be a player in terms of addressing this issue. And in fact, that...
Let me interrupt. I mean, I started with a statement that it was high consumption that could not be sustained. But there's also the concept, I mean, I guess everyone's going to consume something, right? The other sort of side of the coin, I think of the complaint of Monbiot and Klein, is about a corporate culture that has this zombie-like need to keep growing. Right. And of course, then that wraps back. It feeds back into the consumerism, because I think what is Monbiot says, you can now buy a selfie toaster that burns an image of your own face into your bread. I mean, who needs that, really? Right. You can buy it and consume it. But I mean, is that a symptom of corporate culture, or is it a symbol, human desire for something new and shiny? Or I mean, do we blame the consumer, or do you blame the corporation for, again, what Monbiot, let me just quote Monbiot again. He says, the environmental crisis is an inevitable result, not just of neoliberalism, but of capitalism itself. Even the most social democratic kind of philosophy depends on perpetual growth on a finite planet. So perpetual growth on a finite planet, a formula for eventual collapse. So, I mean, his point is that the society as a whole cannot keep growing. And that's some symbiotic relationship between corporations trying to satisfy consumer needs and at the same time stimulating them, and consumers being wanting more and more stuff, right?
And in fact, Monbiot writes, he writes, continued economic growth depends on continued disposal. Unless we rapidly junk the goods we buy, it fails. The growth economy and the throwaway society cannot be separated. Environmental destruction is not a byproduct of this system. It is a necessary element. And the reason why, again, in the United States, this is a controversial perspective is that their dark brilliance. It was a twisted way of doing things, but there was a thought process behind it, a method to the madness. One of the first things that the deniers argued back in the late 1980s, I'm talking about people like Rush Limbaugh and all that, was to argue that the real goal of climate hawks was to stop growth and to get capitalism. So when you have Klein and Monbiot arguing that, yes, growth is the problem, yes, capitalism is the problem, within the United States context, not talking about the rest of the world, but within the United States context, that is something that inevitably you will have deniers seizing upon and saying, see, look, we told you so.
But I guess I would say at that level, the deniers are right, right? Mm-hmm. Is that in order to address the overall issue, must we have a fundamental shift in the way the society operates? I mean, these are profoundly big words, right? But is that required, or could we stay with sort of the, you know, the sort of greeny I've said it myself, right? We need to a growing economy with green energy, clean jobs, you know, windmills, and we'll all have a job and everything's just going to go along fine. Is that even possible? Is there a way to thread the needle and have a society where everyone has a job, but there we're not consuming new things?
Well, it flows right back to that Krugman piece and this whole debate between on the one side what Krugman calls for, which is essentially clean growth, and what Klein and Monbiot are calling for, which is to borrow a very popular phrase from last year, political revolution.
And I was reading
Klein's piece in particular. And I don't mean this to disparage Klein in any way. I started thinking of that famous line from Susan Sarandon last year, where she said that, you know, said something to the effect of Trump's election would cause a backlash that would begin a massive societal shift and a massive, you know, revolution in a progressive direction. And the thing is, if that doesn't happen in the United States, and because of the critical role that the United States would play in leading the world, if that doesn't happen in the United States, planet's pretty much toast.
Oh yeah. I mean, but I'm still stuck on the question of whether or not the role of corporate society and corporate capitalism, right? Whether corporate capitalism, as we currently envision it, let's just leave it there, whatever that is, corporate, is that compatible in any way with a planet that can survive for the next 10,000 years? I mean, that's the time frame you got to think about, right? Is it, I mean, either you say, yes, it is, and somehow you can convince Exxon to do the right thing, or you're saying, no, it isn't, and then you are, you know, sort of an anti-capitalist, the very thing that Rush Limbaugh wants to talk about.
Well, I think as a matter of physics, I think it's beyond dispute that Klein and Monbiot are right. You cannot have infinite growth of any kind on a finite planet, whether it's infinite, you know, consumption, growth of consumption. I know this, it's been a controversial topic that people have debated, you know, infinite population growth. You know, again, in a warming world with climate refugees, we're running out of places to put everybody, as we've seen, and places where we do put them, though, they might be destroyed by hurricanes too. So in that specific sense, Klein and Monbiot are absolutely right about the limits of growth, so to speak. The problem is, within the United States context, how do you sell that politically? It's certainly beyond, it's beyond my pay grade.
I mean, I guess I'm divorcing it, the political sale of the idea, from the sort of philosophical correctness of the idea. Because I agree with you. I mean, it's a tough sell, right? Because America is very much linked to a capitalist approach. On the other hand, I think people are more socialist than they want to agree to. But put that aside. I mean, selling the idea. I mean, there's sort of this, and I don't think it's a sterile discussion, is whether or not you can imagine a society in which there is a corporation that serves a financial bottom line in the absence of some recognition of the limits of the planet. I mean, I guess my own feeling is that it's very hard. The way things are currently established, there's no incentive for Exxon to do anything other than what Exxon is doing now. And consequently, Exxon is bad for the planet. Right? Now, maybe that makes it, I don't know if that, what that makes me in the sort of political philosophy spectrum, right? But you look and say, these things cannot continue as they are. But at the same time, you have, I maintain, I've said before, there's this book by a guy called Piketty, I think it was The Limits of Growth or The Limits of Capitalism or something, a very popular book a couple years ago. And he's arguing that this coming century is going to be a low-growth century, just like the beginning of the 1800s. And the point that stuck with me was how in the beginning of the 1800s, or the late 1700s, if you were a farmer, your child was going to be a farmer. There was no social mobility because the growth rate was so low and no one made a whole bunch of money, right, like a Facebook guy, right? It's only in an atmosphere where we have lots of growth that you can have social mobility, where you know, basically people who are not well-to-do make money and move into the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you build a society that has low growth, or shall we say low impact on the planet,
mm-hmm.
but still provides social mobility for people? And I don't have an answer. But I mean, I see these things as sort of cataclysmic things that either are going to end up with some sort of, you know, huge loss of human life when we get back to some level where, you know, the planet can survive. But as somebody else said, I think it was Jared Diamond in his book, humans always procreate their way out of every crisis. So even if global warming happens and there's millions of people dying, you know, when things settle down, humans will come back and do the same thing again, and destroy the planet a second time.
Mm-hmm.
Was that too far out there, DR? I'm not even sure where I am now, man. Was there a coherent thread in anything I just said?
Not too far out there at all. And it goes back to, again, not to be obsessed with the politics, but how do you convince people that we need less stuff? In other words, you know, when you think of the people who, you know, we all praise, you know, Gore and John Kerry and Bernie Sanders for, you know, taking these stands on climate. But when they all ran for president, did they ever say, and frankly, mm-hmm. could they ever say politically, we must have less growth?
Right.
The answer to that is obvious.
Yeah.
They would have been stoned if they tried to say that.
No, and in my, it's like you look at history over the last 10,000 years. I mean, every ruling class from the Egyptian pharaohs to the Romans. I mean, the people that had the money wanted luxury, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as more people get, you know, sort of a more comfortable existence, humans want luxury, and luxury is basically consumption, and that's
mm-hmm.
So in a sense, it's this dismal thing where you're calling for this sort of Mother Teresa approach to life, where you abjure, forswear any kind of luxury. Like, mm-hmm. that ain't gonna work, right? People aren't gonna sign up for that.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. But I mean, I would, if dear listener, if you haven't read the Monbiot article, I thought that was pretty good. And I think that it's important to understand this concept of neoliberalism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is this, basically, the philosophy that you believe in without even knowing it, that neoliberalism is so ingrained in everyone that it's just taken for granted. But the whole mm-hmm. idea of, you know, profit, bottom line profit, being the determiner of civilizations and of all human action
mm-hmm.
is just a current philosophy. As I was saying before, it's completely distinct from the way that people live in feudal times. And mm-hmm. I don't know which time period I prefer to live in, so put that aside. But the fact that we, as a culture, are driven by the bottom line profit motive is a human creation which can be unmade, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. What man has built, man can also destroy.
Yeah, and man can even destroy a few things he hasn't built,
exactly.
Like the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this was an interesting run around the philosophical barnyard here. I think we've touched mm-hmm. on a few live wires out there. I think it's an interesting question. I hope people think about what the stakes are, because it's really true. And probably somewhere out there now is a, you know, green equivalent of Marx and Lenin writing the book about how we're going to live for the next in the future. And we'll mm-hmm. put up links to those two articles at least, right? Those are two good articles. They'll be in the blog, of course, that we put up each week. That'll be at massclimateaction.org/blog. We'll also put up a link to everything on the Facebook page at /massclimateaction. I would remind you that on September 19th, Tuesday, September 19th, down at the State House will be the a lobbying day in favor of clean energy, in particular the renewable portfolio standard. I urge you, if you can, to get there and take part in that day. It's going to be fun. It'll allow you to, I guess I'm trying to find a joke, to show your capitalist roots or something and be a good American, not a socialist crazy like I am. But go to that, all right, if you can. I will put up a link in the blog. Of course, you can listen to the smartphone. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Overcast, Podbean, SoundCloud, etc. You can also find us on iTunes by searching for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we'll close where we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it's our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the reckless policies of the new administration not be accepted as normal, and that the United States put a long-term, an equitable price on carbon. So, Dia, thank you so much for being here and for guiding our philosophical discussions.
Thanks.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. We'll talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us. And until next time, be green.
Very cool.